This is Beverly Tomasian. We're very excited today to be presenting our Diabetes CDE Exam Bootcamp. This is our second class. And as usual, we have a lot of great content to cover. And so let's go ahead and just jump right in and get started. As you know, our sessions will have seven sessions in total from 11:30 a.m. and to 1 p.m. Pacific time. And after the program, I will stick around to answer any questions offline. Sometimes my audio stops when I end the recording, so just wait for a few seconds and it will come back up. After this presentation is complete, I will upload it onto our online university where you can hear the recorded version, take the quiz, and get your CEs. And here's the beautiful Susan Asensio, our office manager. She is available if you need any additional help or you have any additional questions. So what we're going to cover today: standards of care, treatment of hypertension, lipids, hypoglycemia, monitoring, and sick days. You're wondering, how can we cover all of that in an hour and a half? Well, we're going to move. That's how we're going to do it. The main document I want you to be familiar with for your clinical practice and also for this exam is the ADA standards of care. In your resources, I've posted a link. I would encourage you to download this, read it, read a section at a time. Be very familiar with it for the exam. It will help you a lot. Incorporated into this are not just standards of medical care, but also a lot of the philosophy on the exam. So what are some strategies for improving diabetes care? Now, whenever you see this number on the left of my slide, it means it's referring to the standards of care, and it's the what number standard they are talking about in the ADA. So this is the first standards of care, the first opening paragraphs. And what it says is, based on a recent report by the CDC, only 9% of privately insured patients, less than 7% of privately insured adults with newly diagnosed diabetes joined a self-management education and training program. This is really shocking to me. Less than 7% of privately insured adults, their resources there, yet people aren't signing up and participating and providers aren't referring, even though the data shows that diabetes education self-management programs work. And so the American Diabetes Association is saying, we need to consider different ways of delivering care. And this concept, the chronic care model, might come up on the exam. So what they're seeing is we have to reconceptualize the way we deliver care. We have to optimize provider and team behavior, support patient behavior change, and change the care system. No easy task. We're going to talk about this more in a minute, but first I'd like to do a poll question. What is the preferred approach when providing diabetes education with patients? Is it A, provide patient-centered self-management support, B, instruct all patients to meet national standards? Is it C, highlight risk of complication when goals aren't met? Or is it D, remind them that insulin treatment can be beneficial? So let me go ahead and launch this poll. And again, we're working toward the best answer. Okay, clearly getting a message from all of you that this was way too easy. Okay, I'll work on making this question a little more challenging in the future, or maybe you have been studying, and maybe that's why you're all getting this question right. Thanks for voting, everyone. It's hard for me because I can't see you, so it's really helpful when you answer these poll questions. I'm going to go ahead and close this and just share it with you, because you'll see how on fire you are today. And 100% of you said provide patient-centered self-management support. I just can't tell you how important that is on the exam. They're going to talk about that a lot. They may not ask you directly like I am, but they'll give you case scenarios, vignettes, and they're going to ask you, what's the best strategy? And the underlying theme is what they're trying to get toward, is that we want to be patient-centered. We want to find out their values. We want to find out their behaviors, their limitations, their skill sets. And we want to really promote self-management, support self-management. This is going to come up again and again. So you all are getting that, and that's great. So you can go in knowing that you have a real clear concept of the philosophy of the exam. Now, getting back to the chronic care model, which I did mention there's some questions on, the chronic care model says there's six core elements for optimal diabetes care. So there's proactive versus reactive care delivery system. And we want to be more proactive and not just have patients come into the ED when their diabetes is out of control, but really plan visits and coordinate it through a team. So interdisciplinary team, we've heard that forever. Provide support for self-management. Provide decision support. So helping patients make decisions based on evidence-based guidelines and helping our colleagues make the best decisions too on evidence, not, you know, what they think is right. Just kind of, I had a patient come in to see me the other day and he goes, my provider told me that if I have a low blood sugar, eat peanut butter. Well, I know that eating peanut butter isn't going to raise his blood sugar. So we want to make sure all of our providers have the knowledge necessary to really provide evidence-based content, clinical information systems, tracking patients through registries and evaluating their outcomes and making sure people don't fall through the cracks, community policies and resources to support healthy lifestyles. So what would be an example of a community policy? Well, maybe the policy of the community is to have more walk paths or have one park for every 10 square miles. Another policy that's coming in being suggested is a soda tax. So that's more of a public health policy. And then health systems that create a culture of quality. And so this is the chronic care model, which says instead of just responding to diabetes complications, which 32% of Medicare dollars go to treat diabetes complications, let's be proactive, base it on evidence, get a team together, and create a culture of quality. Keeping it patient-centered, it's clear that optimal diabetes management requires an organized, systematic approach, a dedicated team, working in an environment where patient-centered care is a high priority. Can't say it any better than that. Came right from the ADA. Now, number three standard of care also talks about our initial evaluation and diabetes management planning. So this is a medical evaluation. We're diabetes educators. But part of our assessment, our health assessment, we do want to know. We want to look at the history and physical and see the provider, referring provider's notes. And we're going to also be cognizant of what kind of diabetes, what complications, what treatments have been tried before, and how do we manage risk factors. We're going to support formulating a management plan. So many of us are consultants to providers. That's my role. I'm a nurse, a CDE, I have a master's degree, but I don't have prescriptive authority, so I suggest changes to providers. I serve in a consulting role. Maybe some of you write prescriptions and can order things, so we all have different skill sets and capabilities. So just to kind of know where you fit within that interdisciplinary team. And then we want to provide a basis for continuing care. This is so important for the exam and for real life, is that diabetes is not just a one-time intervention. You have diabetes for a lifetime. We are obligated to provide ongoing care and services for a lifetime. So not just letting the patient loose after they finish their, 9-hour class, but making sure we contact them on an ongoing basis. And in my clinic, we have actually a tickler file. Every year we send our program graduates who come to our classes a reminder note, we're here for you. You can see us 2 to 3 hours, a year, depending on if it's for nutrition or diabetes education. And we want to provide that service to you. We're here for you, and we have a once-a-month support group, another way of reaching out to patients, and we also have an annual walking event. Whatever we can do just to make them feel connected to a community, it's so important. Okay, number three, I'm still on the standards of care. We're going to do an initial evaluation, conditions to look for. If they have type 1 diabetes, and sometimes I've had many patients with, they were said to be type 2s, and they come in to see me, and I'm like, well, they kind of seem more like a type 1 to me. So we're going to assess that too and see if we can't clarify what type of diabetes they have. And oftentimes it's related to their autoimmune diseases. So if they have celiac or thyroid disease, we're going to look to make sure we have the diagnosis is correct. Other conditions that might appear with type 1 or type 2, oh, wow, depression and anxiety. They're thinking up to 20 to 30% of patients with diabetes do suffer with depression, and many of them suffer with severe depression and anxiety. Depression and diabetes or diabetes distress seem to come together as a package for many of our patients. Obstructive sleep apnea. Anybody with insulin resistance, as we talked about in the first boot camp, really has a manifestation of insulin resistance in many ways. Fatty liver disease, obstructive sleep apnea, cancers, some cognitive impairment. As I mentioned, I believe last time, insulin is a neurotransmitter, and so if the blood sugars are high and there's not enough insulin, it can affect cognition. People with diabetes are more likely to get fractures. They have more bone demineralization. Lower testosterone in men, and periodontal disease. And diabetes can also affect hearing. It can actually cause a neuropathy in the bones of the ear. So these are other conditions associated with diabetes that we want to be on the lookout for. Now the foundations of care, you can see I'm on standard number 4. So we're looking for this, we're doing a physical assessment and seeing what the other issues are. We're also looking for depression and anxiety. And now we know to support people towards self-management, there's certain foundations of care. Look what the number 1 foundation is. It doesn't say medical management. It says education. And education is provided by one-on-one sessions, or it can be provided by in a group session. And we do have on our level 2 online courses a program called Setting Up a Successful Diabetes Education Program that talks in detail about what goes into an education program, what are the standards, how do we evaluate patients, and what is required to be recognized by ADA or AADE. And this might be a really helpful program for you to review if you're not very familiar with those standards. Nutrition. We'll be having a class, a boot camp on nutrition later, and physical activity. So these three, wow, these are really the pillars, the foundations of diabetes care. Quitting smoking, psychosocial care, immunizations. We're going to talk about all of those. So education. People with diabetes and pre-diabetes, not just diabetes, but those with pre, should receive diabetes self-management education. And we want to monitor to see if it's effective. We look at quality of life. Are they able to self-manage their diabetes effectively and have a good quality of life? How is their emotional well-being? We know that education results in cost savings and improved outcomes. And the ADA is telling insurers you should be reimbursing this, and they should also be reimbursing for pre-diabetes care. So I'm on standard 4 now, exercise recommendations. Now this is very familiar to most of us, but I do want to say there's some new stuff in here which is pretty cool. Activity update, don't sit for more than 90 minutes at a time. That goes for anyone with diabetes and people without diabetes. Don't sit, get up, move around. It's really important. But the other thing that is really coming out strongly in the new recommendations is that people should, in addition to engaging in 150 minutes of activity a week, like walking twice a week, perform sessions of resistance exercises. So weightlifting, those rubber-handled tubes are also another resistance exercise. So strengthening resistant exercise, because muscles chew sugar. We want to get our people up, and we want to get them doing some weight-bearing or resistance exercises at least twice a week. Standard 4, vaccinations, immunizations. This has changed a little bit, not this slide, but you'll see the next slide. Influenza vaccine, everyone starting at the age of 6 months should get the influenza vaccine and be vaccinated yearly for that. But this is also a newer recommendation, hepatitis B vaccine recommended for people with diabetes ages 19 to 59 who have not been previously vaccinated. And this is due to risk of exposure to hepatitis B. There's a double the risk due to sharing of lancing devices and glucose meters. So we know that people with diabetes like to check their buddies. Well, I like the idea of that, but they can often share hepatitis when they do that. Now the pneumonia vaccinations is new. What they're seeing here, there's two types of pneumonia vaccinations, the PPSV23 and the PCV13. So what they're saying is we should start with the PPSV23 vaccine, all patients starting at age of 2. If you're an adult over the 65 years of age and you have not been previously vaccinated, you should receive the PCV13 followed by the V23, I'll just say the V23, 6 to 12 months after initial vaccination. If you're over the age of 65 and you've been previously vaccinated with the V23, you should receive a follow-up after 12 months with the 13. So what they're saying is to cover the different viral strains, we need two different types of pneumonia vaccination, the V23 and the V13. And you can't give them immediately after each other. There has to be a time lapse, you know, at least 6 to 12 months, because it might be too much for the body. Standard for e-cigarettes. So now we know that people with diabetes shouldn't smoke, but a lot of people have taken up this e-cigarette. Now, this e-cigarettes, which use battery-powered cartridges to produce a nicotine-laced vapor and often contain other bad chemicals and additives, we don't know the long-term outcomes of these. So what we're saying, the American Diabetes Association, they are not supported as an alternative to smoking to facilitate cessation. Smoking and diabetes. Did you know that smoking cigarettes increases the risk of diabetes by 30%? There's something about this nicotine and the cigarette exposure that increases insulin resistance. I have patients come to see me who are smokers, and you could smell it. It's not hard to detect. And I'll say, are you smoking? Yes. Okay, how much? And I go over it every time I see them. And I don't really mind if they get irritated with me, because studies show the more we bring it up, the more likely they are to quit. Look what it says. Ask at every visit. These are the 5 A's and the 1 O that have been shown to help change behavior. Assess. How much are you smoking? Advise. You know, smoking is really harmful for you. And then provide assistance with stop smoking. So have some resources for them that you can share with them to help support their effort to quit. Arrange for referrals, organize your clinic. This is a picture painted by Vincent van Gogh long before we knew the effects of cigarettes. So he figured it out way before the warnings were put on the cigarette labels. In Brazil, this is how they're fighting the smoking epidemic. On all the cigarette packages, they have this note, impotencia. So smoking is not good for your sex life is really the bottom line here. And certainly smoking does decrease blood flow to all parts of the body. Number 5. So I'm on the standards of care. I'm highlighting the standards we need to be familiar with. Prevention or delay of type 2 diabetes. Patients with pre-diabetes, so this is, as we talked about last time, a fasting blood sugar 100 to 125, or an A1C of 5.7 to 6.4, they should be referred to behavioral counseling and a DSME program. To focus on what? To focus on what we know works. This is from the Diabetes Prevention Program, which had demonstrated benefits when people were put on an intensive diet and physical activity with a weight loss target of 7% and activity target of 150 minutes a week. Look what it says. Again, this concept will come back again and again. Follow-up counseling is critical for success, that we need to stay engaged with our patients and really support them on an ongoing basis. So somebody just asked me, is this covered by insurance? I really wish it was. This is a big push right now by the American Diabetes Association. We're meeting with legislators and we're talking to the legislative and staff to say, this should be covered because it helps. We have evidence that this program prevents diabetes, and we know that 1 in 3 Americans have prediabetes. This needs to be covered. So a lot of the private insurance companies will cover it, but a lot of diabetes prevention programs around the country are getting grant monies to provide this. They're partnering with YMCAs. And also, a lot of patients are paying cash for this. So what is the cash payment? It's, you know, it's up to about $400 for this program, which I believe meets for, I want to say, at least 12 to 18 weeks. So it's a long amount of time that they meet to help make these behavior changes. We also, in the ADA standards, can say consider metformin for type 2 prevention, especially for those with a BMI greater than 35 and a history of gestational diabetes. We talked about that last time. Monitor annually and screen and mitigate modifiable cardiovascular risk factors. people with prediabetes are already at risk, almost have a doubling of risk of heart attack and stroke. So prediabetes is not something just to go, oh, you don't have diabetes yet, don't worry about it. No. Prediabetes says you're insulin resistant, you're moving toward diabetes and toward heart disease. So again, I'm not sure why we don't call it something different, like stage one diabetes, to get people's attention and get insurance companies to really help intervene at this point before it moves on to diabetes. So now you're getting my my ideas and concepts about diabetes care. That probably won't be on the exam. That's a Beverly frustrated about the lack of awareness and action by insurance and Medicare to cover prediabetes education. Some private insurance companies do cover it. They're more progressive. Medicare really is dragging their feet. So this is the diabetes prevention program summary, and this will probably be on the exam in some way. We need to know these major landmark studies, what the significance was of them, and how we apply them in our job setting. So let me spend a few minutes going over this. This was first initially conducted by the CDC, and now there's a National Diabetes Prevention Program, which is taking this out to the community. They found 3,000 people with prediabetes, and they randomized them into three groups, 1,000 people in each group, placebo, diet and exercise, or metformin. They watched them for 3 years. They were going to watch them for five, but the results were so profound they had to stop the study and give everybody the treatment. This is shocking. In the standard group, 30% developed diabetes. So let me just go over this. If I have prediabetes and I make no changes in my life, if I have prediabetes, in 3 years, I have a 29% chance of getting diabetes. Right now, there's 86 million people in America, 86 million with prediabetes. So you can see they're evolving over to diabetes at a very fast pace. The lifestyle results, 58% risk reduction. So if I have prediabetes and I conduct myself and do 30 minutes of daily activity and lose 5 to 7% of my body weight, I reduce my risk in 3 years by 58%. If I'm over the age of 60, I decrease my risk by 71%. I do want to point out a very important number. 14% did develop diabetes. So what does this tell me? This tells me that sometimes in spite of my best efforts, I might still get diabetes. The gene is just too strong. And so this is a very important point. These people had coaching and information, and they saw a dietitian and a lifestyle coach, and they saw physical therapists and exercise physiologists. They saw everybody, and 14% still developed it. So sometimes the genes are just strong. The pancreas is not working right. Metformin, 850 twice a day was another intervention. 22% of them developed diabetes, which is lower than the standard group, which was a 31% risk reduction. And they found that metformin was less effective in elderly and thin patients. So you can see number one, treatment, lifestyle, the hardest thing to change, the way we eat and losing weight. But metformin also helped reduce risk. So it would be really great to have a study that combined lifestyle plus metformin to see what kind of risk reduction we could get. This is a great finding from the diabetes prevention program, and this is really motivating for your patients with prediabetes. For every 2.2 pounds of weight loss, risk of type 2 diabetes reduced 13%. So every pound matters. Every pound counts. Don't give up. That weight loss battle is so dang hard. Just keep working at it. All right, ABCs of diabetes. What is the A? Well, you know this, A1C. The B is blood pressure, and the C, I used to say cholesterol, but they've changed the standards. So I renamed the C in my own way, and that's cardiovascular risk reduction. That's what the C stands for in my mind. Let's go over this. So here are the glycemic targets. So this means, what are we trying to get the A1C toward? The A1C less than 7 is a reasonable goal for most adults. But look, so that's just the general goal for most people. Let's go for that. But let's crank it down a little bit for those without a significant risk of hypoglycemia or other adverse effects of treatment. This will be maybe for a newly diagnosed type 2. We can really push that A1C down, or our type 1s. They're young. They have a long life expectancy. Now, this is not when they're children, but maybe they're young adults and they're, you know, past that 18-year-old mark. We might really want to help get that A1C closer to less than 6.5, always looking for that limitation known as hypoglycemia. Now, look at this A1C target. Less than 8% may be appropriate for patients with a history of hypo, limited life expectancy, or those with long-standing diabetes and vascular complications. So I just saw a patient the other day, history of a heart attack and a stroke. He's on insulin 4 times a day. His A1C target is not 6.5. His A1C target, we're happy at 7.2, 7.3. So we adjust the A1C target based on the patient, on their life expectancy, and on their risk of hypo. And this really came from the ACCORD trial. And the ACCORD trial, what they found is that for older patients with cardiovascular disease, if we got that blood sugar down too low, what happened is their risk of mortality went up. So this is a balancing act. Now, how often do we check this A1C? If patient is meeting the goal, so what if my A1C is 5.7? What if it's 6.2? I don't need to get checked every 3 months. Twice a year is fine. But if the patient is not meeting goal, we might check it a little more frequently. Now, this is really important. Pediatric glycemic targets 2015. This was changed. It was different in the past. Are they going to ask you about kids on the exam? Yes, they're going to. So we need to know about adult targets and pediatric targets too. And actually, this is a lot easier than it used to be. The A1C goal is 7.5% for all ages. Wow, that's a lot easier because it used to have like 3 different ranges. However, individualization is still encouraged depending on the patient. For example, a lower goal, less than 7, can be a target without being associated with excessive hypoglycemia. So we're going to adjust our targets based on the patient. We personalize it. But look at the blood glucose targets. Before meals, 90 to 130, bedtime or overnight, they have a lower number. We don't want it less than 90 before they go to sleep and less than 150. So this is a really nice just summary of the targets for pediatrics. What if you work in a pediatric clinic and your targets are different? Well, you just want to know your targets for your own personal knowledge, but for the exam, you always want to know national targets. That's really important. Now, this is a group of people who are near and dear to my heart. And when I teach my diabetes classes, my average age of my participants are 50 to 95. I have a lot of older people, and they always amaze me with their ability to participate, to be, you know, active and to be informed, and their desire to learn as much as they can about diabetes. So they inspire me. But if functional and cognitively intact with significant life expectancy, use the same goals as younger adults. I mean, I have a gal, she's 93, on 4 injections of insulin a day. And she says, I want my A1C less than 7. I am not going to argue with that. So I support her in that. But then I'll have other situations where I have a gentleman taking care of his wife. She's in her 90s, and they're on 4 injections a day. And he's like, this is exhausting for me. And I go, let's see if we can simplify it. And maybe your target for A1C is 7.5. So we adjust based on the outcome and the goals and quality of life. And we're going to assess cardiovascular risk factors. And we want to focus screening for complications on those complications that will lead to functional impairment. Like, for example, if the patient goes blind, obviously that's going to affect their ability to do self-care, and it's going to affect quality of life and depression. So that's another motivation. Let's help keep the blood sugars down to protect the eyes, the kidneys, and the heart. That's our goal, to help maintain as much independence as possible. And we also want to keep a close eye out for depression, because after the age of 65, depression is more likely. Many people become widowed. They live alone. They feel isolated. They can't get out as much. Their bodies are maybe not in good physical shape. And so that's really important. Let's do another poll question. According to the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, ACE, So let me just say, there are going to be questions probably about the AACE goals on the exam. And I do want to say one other thing. Everybody's going to get a different version of the exam. There's many different versions. So your test may not have any questions on the on these guidelines, or your test may have one or two. So what I'm doing is just sharing with you things that have come up that you should be familiar with, and it's just good for our practice too. Okay, according to the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, what is the A1C target goal? Is it A, less than 6.5% for all patients? Is it B, pre-meal glucose less than 7%, pre-meal glucose less than 110? Is it C, A1C less than 7%? Or is it D, A1C less than 6.5 for healthy patients? So let me go ahead and launch this poll and see what you think. So there's two organizations that set targets for diabetes that we use most frequently, and that's the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists and ADA. And I've put both their standards of care statements in your resource page, so you have access to those. And I would look at both of them. And the other thing I would say is, a lot of times the ADA standards are a little more relaxed. AACE standards are a little more stringent. So many times with my patients, I'll start with ADA targets, and if they're meeting those, we can move on to the ACE targets. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share your results. So 88% of you are right on target. You are on target. The target is A1C less than 6.5 for healthy patients. That is the goal as stated by the AACE. And I believe I have it on the next slide. And so you can see here, whenever you see that symbol, it means I'm pulling something from their article. And this came from 2013. As I've said, I have these slides as a resource on your resource page. So they have two targets, A1C less than 6.5 for healthy patients without concurrent illness and at low risk for hypoglycemia. It's more than 6.5. You want to individualize goals for patients with concurrent illness or at risk for hypoglycemia. So that's what they say. And let's just talk a little bit more about the A1C test. So we always say, well, it's a three-month average, but truly, it's not a three-month average. It's actually what we call a weighted mean. And that is the first 2 months of the red blood cell's life, because we're measuring the glycation or sugar coating of red blood cells over 2 to 3 months. That's how long they live. So the first month, the first 2 months carries 50% of the weight. So if the previous 2 months, their blood sugars were very high, that's going to carry 50%, and the most recent month carries the other 50%. So that's how it works. Each 1% point of A1C equals 29 milligrams of blood sugar. If the red blood cells are damaged by hemoglobinopathies, sickle cell disease, or some anemias, it can reduce the accuracy or impact the accuracy of the A1C. So we want to be aware of that. I had a gentleman who was getting blood transfusions, and his A1C looked terrific. Well, yeah, because he was getting new red blood cells put into his bloodstream that were non-glycosylated, so that was not an accurate measurement. Okay, African Americans may have false lows. Just because of the shape of their red blood cells, sometimes they may get some false lows. So that just appears in the ADA standards of care. I thought I'd let you know that. And the great thing about the A1C, it evaluates patients in their fasting state and their fed state and averages it all out over, 3 months. When patients ask me, what is this A1C test, I often give them a donut analogy. So let me just tell you briefly what that is. And I'll say, your little red blood cells look like donuts floating in your blood. Well, if there's been a lot of sugar in your blood for the last 3 months, guess what happens to your donuts? They get sugar-coated or glazed. So the A1C test looks to see how glazed are your donuts, and you do not want them to look like Krispy Kreme donuts. The reason I love this analogy actually is because it's true. Glycosylation means glazed or sugar-coated, and if your red blood cells are sugar-coated, so is the protein, so is the fat. Everything's sugar-coated in your blood, more likely to clot and cause, you know, heart attack and stroke. Get those blood sugars down. The other thing is that the A1C, which is an estimated average glucose over 3 months, I had a gentleman come to see me. He's like, well, I don't know why the doctor sent me to see you. I don't have diabetes. And I'm like, oh, really? What's your A1C? He's like, I don't know, 11.2. So I just showed him my little chart here, and I said, oh, that means your blood sugar is running around 269. And if you don't have diabetes, most people are right around, you know, here between 5 and 6. And so it's a real nice way to show people where they're at. And you can get this little tear-off sheet for free from the American Diabetes Association. So I have that sheet, I tear it off, I show people where they're at and what the target is. And it's really concrete, because people don't really understand A1C, but they understand average blood sugar. Now, how do we get that A1C to target? Well, we've got to get blood sugars to target. And the old blood sugar target was 70 to 130. We've gotten rid of that. The new pre-meal or pre-prandial blood sugar is 80 to 130. So this means when you wake up in the morning, that's a target before lunch and before dinner. 80 to 130, the new target. 1 to 2 hours after a meal, that stayed the same, less than 180. And they actually adjusted this to better reflect actual average glucose levels with A1C target. And also, you know, there's really no benefit for patients to be in the 70s. Really, they're more at risk for hypoglycemia. So let's get that target up a little bit, keep them safe. I love that. Okay, poll question number 3. Which study demonstrated that keeping A1C less than 7% reduces complications for our type 1s? So they're going to ask you on this exam about the different studies that are out there and what their significance was. Was it A, the diabetes prevention trial? Was it B, diabetes control and complications trial? Was it C, United Kingdom prospective diabetes study? Or was it D, the youth trial? Yeah, so you want to be familiar with these studies I'm going to be going over today. They're called, you know, landmark studies that all diabetes educators should know and be able to pull the results out of your pocket at a moment's notice. Because we're always trying to show patients, well, if you achieve these targets based on this study, we know what's going to happen as far as improvement and prevention of complications. All right. Most of you have voted. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Okay, so let me just read it again. Which study demonstrated that keeping A1C less than 7 reduces complications for type 1? So some of the most important words here in this question are, it was a study for type 1. That's probably the most important thing, and the A1C less than 7. So let me share your results. So 13% of you chose a diabetes prevention trial. So that is not the right answer. The diabetes prevention trial was for people with pre-diabetes to see if we could prevent them from going on to get diabetes. So if you got this wrong, it's okay. You just know that you want to really study the different trials and their significance. B, 75% of us chose that. Is that the right answer? Yes, indeed it is. It's a diabetes control and complications trial. And this study results changed the way we did diabetes care. Finally, we had an evidence-based report or study that showed us that keeping A1C less than 7 prevents complications, and it prevents it dramatically. If you chose C, that's also the wrong answer. C is the study looking at people with type 2 diabetes. We'll get to that in a minute. So B is the right answer. Great job. Most of you got that right. So let's keep going. Here it is. The DCCT came out in 1993. It was the largest, most comprehensive diabetes study, a 10-year study. It involved more than 1,400 subjects with type 1 It compared the effects of two treatment regimens, standard therapy, which would be, I think it was MPH and regular twice a day, versus intensive control where you take four injections a day, a bolus at each meal and then basal at night. And so it was, and actually the really remarkable thing about this study is that they let the people with type 1 diabetes adjust their insulin based on what they were going to eat and what their blood sugars were at that moment. Wow, what a concept. So they were doing carb counting and intensive diabetes management. And guess what? The people with diabetes no longer had to eat these regimented meals four times a day. They had a lot more flexibility. So that gets back to empowerment and self-management. Highly successful. Look at this. By getting the A1C less than 7%, they reduce the risk of eye, kidney, and nerve disease 50 to 76%. Here is our message of hope. And this is what I tell patients. Your work is worth it. Your work to get your blood sugars down is worth it because look at the risk reduction. It's dramatic. It's based on science, and we know it works. Keep up the good work. The two different side effects of this intensive management, well, I have one listed here, greater risk of hypoglycemia, but if you can imagine, another issue was weight gain. So a lot of the gals in the, the men and women gained weight. And so we're always trying to be thoughtful of that. The more intensive we get with insulin therapy, many times people gain additional weight, and we want to minimize that as much as possible through thoughtful insulin dosing. Okay, here's the other study, the UKPDS, United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study, a 20-year study, very difficult to conduct. And prospective, as you know, means looking forward. So they start with a group of people and they follow them over time. And that is a really hard to do, but they committed to it, over 5,000 patients. And what they saw is that when they keep that A1C less than 7%, they had really big improvements. But the take-home message for me from the UKPDS is that a 1% decrease in A1C reduces microvascular complications by 35%. And microvascular means eye, kidney, and nerve disease. A 1% decrease in A1C reduces complications, I'm sorry, reduces death by 25%. So this is amazing. A 1% drop in A1C is just 29 points of blood sugar. By dropping your blood sugar 30 points, you reduce your risk of microvascular complications and death. It's worth it. Blood pressure control. By just getting that blood pressure less than 144 over 82, they reduce the risk of heart failure, stroke, and death. So what this study showed us is really blood sugar control is really, it's extremely important, as we all know, but also blood pressure control is just as important. Those two, by getting blood sugar and blood pressure to target, we mitigate eye, kidney, and nerve disease and help reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. Don't give up. Keep trying. Our patients sometimes really get tired of the work, so we have to cheerlead, support, cajole, encourage them to keep going sometimes. This is very important, the legacy effect. For participants of the DCCT and UKPDS, even though over time their blood glucose levels increased, so initially when they were in the study, they had all the support and help and their blood sugars were on target. Well, after they left the study, they kept following these patients and their blood sugars did trend up over time. But even though they trended up, long-lasting benefits of early intensive blood glucose was evident. They had less microvascular complications, but look at this. Less macrovascular, that's heart disease and stroke. Initially in the study, they didn't have less heart disease and stroke early on, but the benefits showed up later. So what is my message on this? Catch early and treat aggressively. Find our people with type 2 diabetes. 25% of all people with diabetes have it and don't know it. How can we find them? We're just going to be looking for people with diabetes wherever we can and really encouraging them to get early and aggressive care. Protect the beta cells, protect your blood vessels, protect your heart. Because cardiovascular disease is a leading cause of mortality and death in diabetes. And actually, cardiovascular disease is the largest contributor to direct and indirect costs. So, many patients with diabetes having stroke, heart attack, lower extremity problems, lots of vascular problems. Large benefits are seen when multiple risk factors are addressed globally. What does that mean? Well, when we address the lipids, the smoking, the blood pressure, the blood glucose, when we address risk of clots, all of those, we can really make a big difference. So this is another change in the standards of care in 2015. And that is, we want to keep that blood pressure less than 140 over 90. It was originally 130 over 80. It's gone up over time, and I'll tell you why. Because studies that indicate that previous blood pressure target of 140 over 80 did not improve outcomes enough to balance the risk of side effects, such as orthostatic hypotension and polypharmacy. As you know, to reach this target of 140 over 80, our patients need to be put on not only one blood pressure medication, but two, and sometimes three. So now they have this big pharmacologic burden where they're taking all these pills. So the benefit did not outweigh the cost. This is our new target, but look what it says. Some patients may benefit from a blood pressure of 130 over 80. This is for younger patients who can achieve it without undue treatment burden. That means they don't have to take three pills to get the blood pressure down. Maybe they really have success by looking at what they're eating, eating more of a DASH diet, fresh fruits and vegetables, looking at their sodium, losing weight, exercising. Wow. What if they can achieve it that way? Terrific. So again, I would say the real important underlying message of this exam and of the standards is we need to personalize these for our patients, recognizing our patient's unique characteristic and adjusting the targets based on what they bring to the table, but knowing what the national targets are at the same time. So hypertension guidelines, we screen, check blood pressure at each visit, and we define hypertension if either systolic or diastolic are elevated. And we have to repeat on a separate day to confirm a diagnosis of hypertension. Really important, this is just a personal note, because I've seen blood pressures taken incorrectly many times. And I've had my blood pressure taken incorrectly many times. And that we need to sit still for 5 minutes, feet on floor, arms supported at heart level, and make sure we get the right size cuff, especially for obese patients. So we know what the target is for blood pressure, 140 over 90. Look what it says. We start with lifestyle, and if their blood pressure is greater than 140 over 90, we do prompt initiation of blood pressure meds. We don't wait 3 months to see what's happening. We've got to start the medication pretty quickly to help prevent any cardiovascular event. Now, when they say lifestyle, what does that mean? I want to give you what it means, and that is losing weight. You know the numbers, 5 to 7%. This is from the ADA standards, DASH diet, DASH style diet, moving to the fresh fruit, veggies, whole grains, reducing sodium and increasing potassium, and look at alcohol intake, get active. And then if the patients do have the blood pressure of 120 over 80, it doesn't mean they're free. No, we want to still encourage lifestyle changes to get their blood pressure to target. So if they're greater than 120 over 80, we still encourage them to keep as healthy as possible. But when they reach this target of 140 over 90, we need to take action, and that means lifestyle plus medication. What is a treatment for blood pressure? Well, the first line blood pressure drugs are ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers, the ARBs. And normally, there's some great studies showing for type 2s, these are very effective, but either one is terrific. And if one class is not tolerated, the other should be tried. So I want to say, in your resource page, I have listed all of the blood pressure medications that are currently available and all the cholesterol medications that are available. So you can take a look at those, and those give you some more information. So on the exam, you may ask me, are they going to ask about blood pressure medications? They might ask you general concepts like, what are some of the side effects that patients on blood pressure medications should know? And you all know what those are, right? What should they be aware of? Well, orthostatic hypotension, and also electrolyte changes. So those are the two main things. And some of the blood pressure medications like the ACE inhibitors can cause a cough. So the main thing we want to do is assess their blood pressure, look for orthostatic hypotension, evaluate electrolytes, and see if they're having any other side effects related with it. And that's all kind of listed on those sheets that I have in your resource page. Multiple drug therapy often required, so including an ACE or an ARB. That doesn't mean an and. Usually they're recommending we don't do ACE plus ARBs. Either one, ACE or ARB at max dose plus a thiazide diuretic. So the diuretic really potentiates either one of these to work their best. Okay, so that's blood pressure. We want to get that blood pressure less than 140 over 90, but right, let me just go over that one more time. Right when we see it moving up above 120 over 80, we take action. Let's talk about hyperlipidemia. So if you're like me, old school, I just had this number memorized, LDL less than 100, if you have heart disease less than 70, totally changed that. Statin treatment and lipid monitoring were revised to reflect the 2013 findings of the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. So they said, we don't need to worry about what their LDL is. What we need to do is start statin therapy. Statin therapy is no longer based on LDL. Starting and dosing stratification is driven by risk status. So generally the rule of thumb is that if you're over 40 and you have diabetes, you should be on a statin medication. If you're under 40 and you have diabetes, we're going to assess your risk. And if you have risk factors for heart disease, you're going to go on a statin too. So what they say is screening lipid profile is recommended at time of diagnosis and or at 40 years and periodically thereafter, every 1 to 2 years. But really, that number of LDL doesn't inform us of starting a statin or not starting a statin. They just say, get them on a statin if they're over 40 with diabetes. But they also do say something really important, and this is more comprehensive than it's ever been. They say start with lifestyle. Reduce trans fat, saturated fat, and cholesterol. So seeing a dietitian for all people with diabetes is critical so they can understand where they're getting their fats from. And you want to increase your intake of omega-3 fatty acids through salmon and other fish, viscous fiber, and plant stanols or sterols like benecol. These have plant sterols in there and stanols to help lower cholesterol. And plant stanols and sterols also are in grains, vegetables, fruits, legumes, nuts, and seeds. You can also find them added to some OJ products. So look in the store for that. But the American Diabetes Association does say these seem to be helpful for lowering cholesterol. Lose weight if needed. Get active. So lifestyle, and you can see the first lifestyle they talk about is changing the way we eat. And the new guidelines came out, the proposed guidelines for the federal government as far as nutrition guidelines. And the researchers said we should be eating more plant-based foods. We don't need this much meat, which is very interesting. Okay, more to come on that. 8, dyslipidemia management. We're still on cardiovascular risk mitigation. Intensify lifestyle therapy and optimize glucose control for patients with triglycerides more than 150 and HDL less than 40 and less than 50. So we know that when you get blood sugars down, triglycerides improve. So just by getting A1Cs down, triglycerides usually come down with that, and exercise will crank up that HDL. Exercise to have fun and be healthy, not just to lose weight. So here's the ADA guidelines. I just took a little clip out of the standards. Recommendations for statin treatment in people with diabetes. Risk factors, less than 40, they have no risk factors, don't start them on a statin. But if they have heart risk factors listed down here, or overt CVD, we need to start them on a statin. 40 to 75 years old, you can see we still start them on a statin, even if they have no cardiovascular risk factors. Okay, Wow. And then if they do have cardiovascular risk factors, we start them on more intense statin dosing. And this is based on the AHA and the College of Cardiology guidelines. More than 75 years of age, look at this. We're still going to start them on a statin. And as I've mentioned, they list down here the risk factors. And here I've just listed what it means by high intensity statins, moderate, and low intensity, just for your information. Do I think this will be on the exam? I don't think so. I mean, the concepts will be on the exam. I don't think they're going to ask you the dosing for a high intensity statin, but you might just want to be familiar with that chart. So the test was just rewritten last year. I don't know how much revision will be done this year, but they might ask about the standards for cholesterol. That might come up on the exam. So always know the most recent standards. And anyways, for our practice, we should know this stuff. You know, what statin is recommended based on our patient's risk status? Because we're going to help prevent heart attack and stroke by being more familiar with this. Now, aspirin therapy is also recommended for patients. So let's see who should be on it. Aspirin is not recommended for diabetes if low heart risk and under the age of 50 for women and 60 for men. We're going to start using it though when men turn 50 and women turn 60 who smoke or have cardiovascular risk factor. And we're going to use aspirin therapy for diabetes patients with a history of heart disease. And you can see there's other anti-clotting agents that we might use in combination, or we might use instead of aspirin if patients have allergies. Coronary heart disease. In patients with known heart disease, so if a patient comes in to see you and they've had a heart attack or a stroke, they should be on these three medications: aspirin, statin, blood pressure medication, and of course lifestyle. But this is just quickly, we should evaluate if they're on these, and if they're not, we want to ask the patient about that. Consider ACE inhibitor to reduce risk of cardiovascular event. And patients with prior MI, beta blocker should be continued 2 years after the event. I would be familiar with that. Post-MI, beta blockers are the blood pressure medication of choice for at least 2 years after the event. Actos and Avandia, we'll be talking about those in an upcoming program, should not be used for patients with CHF. And in patients with stable CHF, metformin can be used if the renal function is normal. So this is all great information to know, really good. Let's just take a look at a case study based on this information we've just accumulated. He's 78 years old. He smokes a pack a day. What are we going to tell him? We're going to tell him to quit smoking. We're going to provide him with resources and referrals, and we're going to keep assessing him. His A1C is 8.1. It's down from 10.4, so something good is happening. Here's his blood pressure, 136 over 76. His morning blood sugars are 100. His 2 hours after meals are 190. Here's his cholesterol, triglyceride. Oh, that's looking pretty good. 54. HDL is 46. And LDL is 98. So his cholesterol is looking, his triglycerides and HDL are pretty good. His LDL, well, you know, where it's a little bit elevated. Insulin, 16 units of Lantus at bedtime. Benazepril, what is that? What kind of medication? It's an ACE inhibitor. He's on 20 milligrams. Metoprolol, what is that? It's a beta blocker. So that's good because he's had a heart attack, or well, he has a high. Well, I'm going to tell you, it doesn't say in here he's had a heart attack. This is actually based on a true patient. I remember he had a heart attack. So anytime you see somebody on a beta blocker, it cues me and they've had some cardiovascular event. He's on warfarin. What's that for? Sure, blood clotting, to stop the blood clotting. And Actos, really, 15 milligrams. So we're not really sure if that's the best medication for him given his risk profile. So what class of medications is this patient on? We've talked about that. Any special instructions? Oh, this is an interesting question I'm asking. He's on metoprolol, a beta blocker, and insulin. So you all know that beta blockers can diminish your sensitivity to hypoglycemia. And so we want to let him know he needs to keep a close eye on his blood sugars because he may not feel if he's going low. But I do want to tell you, patients on beta blockers who get hypoglycemia often do sweat. So the sweat breaks through. It's not blocked by the beta blocker. So the sweating is often apparent. So that's one thing they can look for. But my question here is any medication missing? So here's our guy, 78-year-old, A1C 8.1. We know this about him. LDL 98 smokes. Based on ADA guidelines, what medication is missing? So let's launch this. Is it sulfonylureas, vitamin supplements, B? Is it C, SGLT2 inhibitor, or is it D, statin? Okay, Kathleen, help me out here. She says, Beverly, you have a, she gave me the correct spelling from metoprolol. Thank you very much. I'll fix that for my next slide. See, you guys always help me improve. You help me get better over time. So I appreciate all of your feedback. Okay, 67% of you have voted. I appreciate that. I'm going to close the poll. All right, and share. So once again, either this question is too easy or you guys are just on fire. So I'm just going to say you guys are on fire because he is missing a statin. So I kind of was trying to trick you saying his LDL is 98, but we know from the guidelines that who cares what his LDL is? He's high risk for cardiovascular disease. He needs to be on a statin. And by the way, let's get him to see the dietitian, the stop smoking person, and get him in a diabetes education program. And maybe he should even see the pharmacist, right, to make sure his meds are all working in conjunction. So we definitely need to take a team approach. This man needs a lot of help. So the ABCs of diabetes, A1C less than 7%, we customize that goal. Pre-meal blood glucose targets, 80 to 130. Post-meal, less than 180. Here's his blood pressure target, 140 over 90. And for the C, cardiovascular risk reduction. Okay, in addition to all of that, look at all the work a person with diabetes has to do. They have to get their A1C checked at least twice a year, more frequently if it's elevated. Blood pressure each visit, cholesterol. Yearly, look at less if normal. We know we can check it every other year. We got to weigh every year. Oh, that's awful. We've got to look at microalbuminuria, glomerular filtration rate, creatinine yearly. Eye exam yearly, dental care at least twice a year. Foot exam yearly, but more if high risk. Physical activity plan. Preconception counseling. So who do we counsel about preventing pregnancy until they're ready? And that is any woman with diabetes who is menstruating. Because before a woman gets pregnant, she needs to have her A1C at target. So if you're working with women who are menstruating, we need to discuss, are they ready to have a child? And if not, let's make sure we're have the A1C at target before they get pregnant. It's really so important. Let's take a look at Mr. Jones. He's 64 years old with type 2 diabetes for 11 years. And if you look at your handout, I kind of modified Mr. Jones. It's different from your handout, so you know how us speakers are. We always change stuff up. But it's not that big of a deal. He has a history of heart disease on glyburide 10 milligrams twice a day. Uh-oh. What's glyburide? Well, glyburide's a sulfonylurea, and it can really get your blood sugars to target. Look at his A1C. Wow, 6.3. What's the target? Less than 7. How's his HDL looking? Well, we'd like it more than 40, but it's pretty close. How about his triglycerides? Wow, 260. It's interesting because usually triglycerides are elevated when blood sugar is elevated, but his A1C is on target. So what's going on here? Well, we might look at the beers, 3 beers a day, right? That might be influencing triglycerides because often triglycerides do go up with alcohol intake. Proteinuria was negative. Is that good enough? No. We've got to look at microalbuminuria, GFR, creatinine. That's a late indicator of kidney disease. How about his blood pressure? Is that at target? Not really. We won at 140 over 90. He's already had a heart attack or a stroke. This is a high-risk gentleman. So we're really worried about him, his cardiovascular health. Let's see what he does for self-care. He walks the dog around the block 3 times a week. Is that exercise? Yes, it absolutely is. So we're excited about that. Maybe he can go 4 days a week, or maybe he can do 2 blocks instead of one, if he's willing. He bowls every Friday. Is that exercise? Well, yeah, it's weight-bearing. Okay, wait, 3 beers a day. Is that exercise? Well, 40 ounces might be considered exercise, but, 3 beers a day, ew, I'm kind of worried about that because the ADA guidelines say 2 drinks a day. So he's a little bit over, and we know his triglycerides are high. So what are your concerns about this patient? Well, I think I've kind of outlined them. We're worried about his cardiovascular health, and we're worried about his triglycerides and the relationship between triglycerides and beer. And I don't know if he lives alone. I'm kind of worried about his safety because he tells you the next thing. I get shaky a lot. Ooh, why is he getting shaky? What do you all think could be a reason? Let's keep going and I have a little quiz on him in a few minutes. So let's talk a little bit now, shift gears, talk about hypoglycemia. And there are more standards of care integrated into this component. But we do define hypoglycemia as a limiting factor. You can get blood sugars down so low, but if you go too low, the patient experiences the consequence. And here's a person working in her office getting a low blood sugar, and you can see all the symptoms she's getting. And I just want to say all of us have our own particular sign of low blood sugar. You could tell me what yours is, even if you don't have diabetes. So we want our patients to know their sign. 50% of episodes occur during the night, and that is really dangerous. You may not wake up. There is death associated with hypoglycemia secondary to sulfonylureas. Glyburide is the worst. Glyburide causes the most severe hypoglycemia. So the American Diabetes Association is really recommending we limit the use of that just based on its potential to cause severe hypo. And the blood glucose levels don't really describe severity. Response is individual. I've had patients who feel low when their blood sugar is 100. So I know they're running high a lot. And then I have patients who say, oh, I don't feel anything till I'm 40. We'll talk about that more because that makes Beverly nervous. Here's hypoglycemia symptoms. These are the autonomic symptoms, so that's flight or fight. When we get low, we release adrenaline. We release adrenaline, and that helps to increase insulin resistance and crank up our blood sugars. It helps the liver to release sugar. So adrenaline is a very important hormone that fights against hypoglycemia. And then here's all the, that's adrenaline response. Now, neuroglycopenia is when the brain isn't getting enough sugar. So nerve or brain, sugar, not enough. And that can lead to other things, inability to speak, irritability, drowsiness, dizziness, blurred vision, confusion, feeling faint. I had a patient just came to see me the other day, and he gets very belligerent, and he won't let anybody give him food when his blood sugar's in the 50s. He just pushes them away. And so that really brought to mind that we want to catch low blood sugar early on and treat it right away. Don't wait. Because when you get to this place, which is usually blood sugars 40 to 50s, you may not be able to figure out how to get to the refrigerator, what to do. Your brain isn't getting enough glucose. So here's a glycemic threshold value kind of slide that shows when we're 80s and 90s, there's still some endogenous insulin floating around. But once we get into the 70s, we are in the hypoglycemic state. We're releasing stress hormones, glucagon, adrenaline, to help increase our blood sugars. When we get into the 60s, we're definitely symptomatic. Now we're relying on other hormones, growth hormone, cortisol. When we're in the 50s, we are starting to have cognitive deterioration. When we're in the 40s, neuroglycopenia. So this is just kind of a pathophysiologic response threshold. Everybody's different, but this is, we know I've talked to hundreds of patients, and this seems to be pretty right on for most patients, right around 40 to 50s. they cannot think anymore. And so our main goal is to keep that blood sugar, you know, in the 80s to prevent this from happening. Catch it early, treat it aggressively. So you remember Mr. Jones, the guy who's drinking three beers and his A1C is 6.3 and all that? Which of the following is putting Mr. Jones at risk for hypoglycemia? Is it three beers a day? Is it elevated triglyceride levels? Is it limited income to purchase food? Or is it hypoglycemia unawareness? And on the exam, they're going to be doing a lot of these types of things. They're going to give you a vignette, and then they're going to ask you several questions on a vignette. So this is a very typical type of situation. And so you want to think, which of the following puts Mr. Jones at risk for hypoglycemia? I'm going to say one more thing that might help you out, because I can see what you're choosing now as your answers. And you only can use what you are provided in the vignette. So when you're taking the exam, don't add anything in that's not there. Okay. Thank you for voting, everyone. I'm going to close this poll. So let me just go back to him, because... Okay, 64 years old, type 2 for 11 years, history of heart disease, ongliburide, sulfonylurea. Here's his A1C, and he tells you, I get shaky a lot. What is shaky a sign of? Hypoglycemia. And what's producing that shaky feeling? Adrenaline, epinephrine. Okay, so that's really important. So let me share what you voted on. So A is the right answer. Alcohol, beer, wine, hard liquor cause hypoglycemia. And so from the information we had on that vignette, the only thing that we could see is that it's the beer causing the low blood sugar, because we know that beer blocks the liver from releasing glucose, its glycogen stores. So beer is the culprit here. But I do want to point out 40% of you chose hypoglycemia unawareness. And so I did put that answer in there as a juicy answer to kind of lure you in. But I do want to say we never mentioned there that he doesn't feel anything. He has no signs of hypoglycemia. I actually very specifically said he gets shaky. So shaky, a person with hypoglycemia unawareness would not get shaky. You know, they wouldn't feel anything. And anyways, I mentioned nothing about that in the test question. So it was a few slides back, so you might have forgotten all the details, but I just want to say, if you chose that answer, you just might want to gently remind yourself, okay, only use what's in the test question and don't add anything else in there. Okay, so if you chose D, that's good to keep in mind, but guess what? 61% of you got that question right, so good job. So here's some hypoglycemia clinical risk factors. Who's at risk for having hypoglycemia? We definitely know the older we are, if we have impaired kidney or liver function, if we're on intensive insulin or sulfonylureas, if our A1C is low, his was 6.3, he's at real high risk. If you have a history of frequent lows, alcohol intake, I added that to your slide, so go ahead and add that in. Or if you have any neuropathy. And as I mentioned, 50% of lows happen during the night. So we definitely want to find out if our patients are having lows at night. And we're going to ask them, are you ever having vivid dreams? You wake up with a headache, night sweats, wake up hungry, or maybe their morning blood sugars are high. All of those clue us in that they're getting nighttime low. And then I want to talk a little bit more about hypoglycemia awareness. So hypoglycemia awareness is based on the adrenergic system and the autonomic system, where we release stress hormones, epinephrine, adrenaline, corticosteroids to raise our blood sugars. But for type 1s, after they've had diabetes to 2 to 5 years, the glucagon secretion is impaired and epinephrine secretion becomes primary mechanism. And over time, even the epinephrine response is diminished or delayed. And that decreases awareness of hypo and hormonal responses. And so if you lose awareness of the low blood sugar, it can be very dangerous because your blood sugar could be in the 50s and you don't feel anything. And so we really want patients in that situation, number one thing is to get their blood sugars above 100 for a few months. And that's from the work of Dr. Philip Cryer, C-R-Y-E-R. And he looked at people who had hypoglycemia unawareness, and he saw that if they could get their blood sugars above 100, 100 to 130 for a few months, they regained some of that epinephrine, adrenaline, and glucagon response, and they could sense low blood sugars better. And so you want patients who are struggling with this hypoglycemia unawareness to identify any symptoms. When they get low blood sugar, can you identify anything you feel? I had one guy whose lip would twitch. Okay, let's hold on to that. Whenever you feel your lip twitching, eat something right away, because he may already be 40 at that point. Alcohol can increase the risk. Beta blockers may mask early signs, so we definitely want to make sure if they're on a beta blocker that they might only sweat and that they need to check their blood sugars more frequently. So keeping track of that. So the treatment of low blood sugar, if that blood sugar is less than 70, we're going to eat 15 grams of carbohydrate, which will raise the blood sugar about 45 points at the highest. So they have to retest in 15 minutes. If it's still below target, eat some more. And then follow up with usual snack. And for blood sugars really low, it takes time to recover, especially your brain takes time to recover. Now, treatment of severe hypoglycemia. This means when you say severe, that the person needs the help of somebody else. They cannot self-treat. They've lost the ability to do that. If they can swallow without risk of aspiration, I've had many family members do this. You can take honey or corn syrup and put it inside the cheek. But if unable to swallow, if it's not safe, we need to give D50 IV or glucagon. Now, glucagon is not self-injected. We have to teach somebody to do that. And this is an important piece of information you might see on the exam. For adults, we give 1 milligram, the full injection. And for children under 20 kilograms, we give half the dose, 5.5 milligrams. Now, what glucagon does is it tells the liver to release its glycogen stores. So the glycogen stores might be really low in that liver. We don't know when this person ate last. So the glycemic effect is short-lived. It's just going to raise the blood sugar 20 to 30 points. So they must eat food, carbohydrate in particular, as soon as possible. And or if they're in an emergency situation or in a hospital, their paramedics are there, they're going to give them some maybe D50 or start an IV with some dextrose in it. You need a prescription for this, and you want to check expiration date. And so as soon as that person is able, when they wake up, they oftentimes feel nauseated. They have a very bad headache. The last thing they want to do is eat. We really just need to say you have to eat because we want to keep your blood sugars above target. And of course, checking the blood sugars, you know, every 15 minutes till they're stabilized is really important. Here's the Eli Lilly Glucagon Emergency Kit. And you can see there's instructions here. It's in powder form. Here's the water. So you have to take off the cap and put it into the glucagon and shake it up and then pull the glucagon back into the syringe and then inject it into the muscle or the fat. It doesn't matter. Just get it in. I like to say, I don't care where you do it. Just get it in somewhere. So it can be in the buttocks. It can be in the arm. Who cares? Just they need that glucagon. But the main thing we really want to focus on is preventing low blood sugars. To prevent nighttime lows, if you need a snack, eat it. If we want that bedtime blood sugar more than 110, and if it's lower than that, we may need to have them eat more or reduce insulin. So evaluate nighttime insulin or medications. If they had increased activity during the day, and this happens a lot in the winter when the gentlemen are or the women are out there raking the leaves, and then later on that night they get a low blood sugar. So that's kind of a delayed hypoglycemic response that can happen, especially if they're more active than usual. We'll see it happen oftentimes at night. And we want to monitor their kidney function and weight changes. If their kidney function diminishes, they may need less medication and they're more risk for hypo because kidneys clear used medication and insulin if you lose weight, you need less medication. We're always trying to give less medication if they do drop some pounds. And then alcohol. So these are just some things. If patients are getting low blood sugar, generally I try and cut back on their medication. That's always my number one target. But also evaluate other factors that might be contributing to that. Okay, so in the last few minutes, we're going to just summarize monitoring sick day management and hospital goals. Can we do it? Yes, we can. Poll question number 6. What is the most effective way to teach blood glucose monitoring? Is it A? I'm going to launch this. Ask the patient to carefully read the instructions in the box. Is it B? Send the patient home with video instruction. Is it C? Demonstrate how to use the meter. Or is it D? Review the steps and ask the patient for a return demonstration. All right. All right, well, let's take a few more seconds because once again, you all are just on fire here. I'm going to go ahead and take one more second. Close the poll. Okay, let me share your results with you. Nobody said ask the patient to read the instructions in the box. Okay, great, because that doesn't help a person learn. I had actually a patient tell me they called their office to learn about how to use a meter, and somebody answered the phone and said, well, just read the instructions. Okay, I don't need to say anything else about that. B, send patient home with a video. Nobody chose that. C, demonstrate how to use a meter. So some of you chose that. So if we show somebody how to do it, it doesn't mean they know how to do it. So demonstrating is important, but most important is D, review the steps and ask the patient for return demonstration. So D is the right answer because we want a patient to show us a return demonstration that they grasp the concept. It is scary, poking your finger, getting blood, all of that. And so you want to make sure they're really comfortable with the process. And then the patients may say to you, why do I need to check my blood sugar? I hate this. I don't want to poke myself. And so we want to have some reasons behind why it is helpful. And a lot of times I'll say to my patients, you just feel better. You have more mastery over your diabetes. And the other thing is it can see if the plan is working and it can help you figure out, what does pizza do to my blood sugar? Or what does Chinese food do? Or what does rice do? So we call this paired glucose testing. And that is test your blood sugar before you eat a meal and then check it 2 hours after and see how that particular food affects you. Or you could go check your blood sugar before you exercise and then check it 2 hours later. How does exercise affect you? So it gives you information, immediate feedback of how you're doing with your diabetes. We want to be realistic in asking patients to check. Type 2 on oral medications, Medicare only covers 100 strips for 3 months. I would know this for the exam. So it's based on the individual. We want to consider the timing of their meds, their goals. You know, if their A1C is 6.4 and they're on metformin, you know, once a day would be plenty. Maybe they could check 3 times a week. But if their A1C is 10.7 and they're on insulin, they're going to need to check more often. So we have to adjust this based on their resources and their targets. This is from the American Diabetes Association. And what they say is we want to self-monitor as needed, but good times to check are before meals, snacks, and bedtime. Occasionally post-prandial and before exercise. And then when the patient suspects their blood sugar is low, but look at this. After treating low blood sugar, so sometimes you'll see I had a test question. The patient gets signs of low blood sugar. What should they do first, eat or check? And I would say, and this the ADA supports this, is treat the low blood sugar right away. Eat something, then check afterward when you have that food working in you. Because if you eat and check your blood sugars a few minutes later, you'll still catch the low. You should check your blood sugar before doing critical tasks such as driving, and some patients will need to test more depending on activity level and frequency of eating. But be practical. No 2 patients or 2 days are alike. And then some baseline learning. We want to make sure our patients know these, how to perform quality control, how to dispose of lancets. I had a guy who's had diabetes for 40 years, was still throwing his lancets and syringes in the trash. So we had a good talk about that. 800 number on the back. And on previous exams, they often will say, what is the number one reason for inaccurate readings? And user error is the most common reason. Alternate site testing, so we know we can use other parts of the body besides the fingers to test blood sugars. When is it okay? Well, finger fatigue, they're not at risk for hypo, their blood sugars are stable, and their blood glucose is less than 90. We need to recheck on the finger, but not indicated during pregnancy or an intensive insulin therapy, during hypoglycemia or illness. It's not as accurate during glucose fluctuations. And I'm just going to briefly mention that a lot of our patients don't want to check their blood sugars because they think if their blood sugars are high, they're bad. And if their blood sugars are on target, they're good. It's not about them being bad or good. It's about the work they're doing. So I say stuff like this: I'm impressed that you are checking your blood sugar and writing it down. And then if they're doing it well, I say, what's helping you succeed at this? And then if they're really skipping times or not checking that frequently, this is called curiosity-based questioning. I'm really interested to see that you are skipping some days. Can you share more about that? So it's just non-judgmental, and it just gives information about what works and what doesn't work. Let's talk about sick days. So I have a poll question number 7. What is the best sick day recommendation for someone with type 2 diabetes? Is it A, stop all diabetes medications? Is it B, test blood glucose every 1 to 2 hours? Is it C, continue to take diabetes medications? Or is it D, only drink sugar-free beverages? What's the best recommendation for a type 2s? And on the exam, they'll have a lot of questions like this, where you have to differentiate between two answers that could be right, but you want to choose the best answer. So I'm trying to give you all a lot of practice doing that. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. So none of you chose A. Great job. So that A is a wrong answer, but about 20% of you chose B, and B is actually a juicy answer. You want to choose it, but it's not right for this situation. So this person, you know, doesn't have type 1. It doesn't say they're acutely ill. So generally we say if you are sick, test blood glucose every 4 hours. So 1 to 2 would be really kind of overkill. It would be overdoing it. So the best answer is what 82% of you chose, and that is continue to take your diabetes medication. Even when you're sick, take your medications. Now you may say, well, what about metformin? Some patients when they're sick shouldn't take that, but we weren't told they're on metformin. We don't know what medications they're on. Maybe they're on Januvia, or maybe they're on an SGLT2 inhibitor like Invokana. And so what we have to do is choose the best answer, and that is C, continue to take your diabetes meds. And 82% of you got that right. If you didn't, that's okay. You just kind of want to be familiar with the standards around sick days and treatment for that, which I'll be going over in a minute. Okay. So sick day guidelines is that you want to continue to take your diabetes medication. You may just need to adjust dose up or down. Test blood sugar every 4 hours, drink a lot of liquids, and then make sure to contact your physician. And if you're sick and your blood sugar is more than 240, you might want to check your urine ketones. And this is a really good slide I go over with my patients, and that is when to call the doctor, when to get help, because they don't always know, and they end up in the ER really compromised. If you're vomiting or at risk for dehydration, anybody difficulty breathing, or that blood sugar is more than 300, you just can't get it down. Temperature is 101, and you have ketones in your urine. And then if our patients are admitted to the hospital, what do we do then? And so I'm going to just take about 5 more minutes to wrap up on the hospital setting, because there are some questions on it. So I want to, on the exam in the hospital, so I want to spend a few minutes on this. Hospitals and hyperglycemia, what's the big deal? Well, hyperglycemia is associated with increased risk of death and complications in the hospital setting. If your blood sugars are high, you're clotting more, you're not as able to fight off infection, you're more likely to get infections and have cardiovascular events and longer lengths of stay. So even in the hospital setting, we can find people with pre-diabetes. So we can look at labs in the hospital and see who's running high. Just because they're sick, their pancreas should still be able to control the blood sugars. So if they're sick and their blood sugars are elevated, it's telling me their pancreas isn't working right. Let's find people with pre-diabetes and let them know. And then we're going to find people with undiagnosed diabetes in the hospital setting. There was a study done that about 16% of people admitted to the hospital have undiagnosed diabetes. Let's find them and make sure they get the appropriate treatment. So we're going to look at our fasting and our random and A1Cs to see if people have diabetes not diagnosed. Any blood glucose above 140 requires treatment in the hospital setting, and that's from the hospital guidelines to management of diabetes, and that's, I'm going to post that on your resources. So let's take a look at Mrs. S. Mrs. S. is 78 years old. Now you're wondering, why is this so wordy? Because believe me, on the test they're going to have a lot of wordy questions. Mrs. S. is 78 years old, admitted to the hospital with a UTI. She has type 2 diabetes and her admission A1C is 8.7. Her creatinine is 1.5. Her usual medication at home is metformin and glyburide. Which of the following statements are true during her hospital stay? Is it A, keep her on metformin and glyburide and monitor her blood glucose? Is it B, hold the glyburide and add sliding scale insulin? Is it C, continue oral meds and start an insulin drip? Or is it D, hold oral meds and start her on insulin therapy? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and launch this. I added this late in the game, so it's not in your handout, but I will redo the handout so all these poll questions are in there. So what's the best answer for her? So she's 78, UTI, type 2, A1C is 8.7, her creatinine is 1.5, she's on metformin and glyburide at home. Which of the following statements are true during the hospital stay? Should we keep her on her metformin, which is A, and her glyburide? B, should we hold the glyburide and add sliding scale? C, should we continue oral meds and start a drip? Or D, hold the oral meds and start on insulin therapy? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share the results. And so there are guidelines that inform us what to do, and we'll go over those in a minute. But 20% of you said hold the glyburide and add sliding scale. So those are no longer the guidelines for the hospital stay. You're going to see what we do. There's two things that are wrong with that answer. Number one, they say stop all oral meds during the hospital stay. And B, do not use sliding scale insulin therapy. It doesn't work. So those are the new guidelines. So I'm glad I put this up here so that you can kind of know that, oh, the guidelines have changed. We do things differently. But 82% of you got that right. So great job, team. Let's just go through a few more slides. And this is the ADA standards of care for hospitalization. Know this. Critically ill patients, if their blood sugar is more than 180, start insulin. And critically ill patients, we want to keep that blood sugar 140 to 180. Non-critically ill patients, pre-meal goal less than 140, less than 180 post-meal. So very similar to the outpatient. Insulin therapy is preferred treatment. And this is from the ADA standards of care. Stop oral agents, i.e. metformin and sulfonylurea on admission. And the sole use of sliding scale insulin is discouraged. For discharge, oral meds can be resumed. That's really important to know. So we want to start basal bolus therapy, MPH and regular, or long-acting and rapid-acting, or premixed insulin. So we don't want to just do sliding scale in the hospital. We want to do thoughtful insulin therapy. And when our patients are getting ready for surgery, we want to try and make sure they have surgery in the morning, most important. And if they're on oral medications, we just hold the morning oral medications. If they're on basal insulin, for type 2s, we give 50 to 100% of the usual AM basal dose. And for type 1s, we give 100% of the basal dose. So that's kind of important to know. For type 2s, we do cut back on basal a little bit if they're going to be NPO or go for surgery. And type 1s, we give the entire amount because basal insulin shouldn't cause hypoglycemia for type 1s if they're not eating. It just keeps their blood sugars constant. Bolus insulin, use mild insulin bolus coverage for both type 1s or type 2s. So if needed, and generally we would say only for, you know, elevated blood sugars. And then the anesthesiologist is going to have to really monitor their blood sugars intraoperatively. Online courses to review. So we can't cover it all in this boot camp, but I do have a half-hour program on level 2 on hyperglycemic crisis, DKA, HHS. Setting up a successful diabetes program is another course you might want to take a look at. And I also have an online course on chronic complications that I just have updated. And so what I'm trying to do in this boot camp is cover the most important critical information, but there is other information out there you want to be familiar and comfortable with. So I want to thank you so much. You want to make sure to be familiar with your standards of care, glucose goals. And I do have two other programs on diabetes, you know, during pregnancy, and also a program on kids and diabetes that are available to supplement your information also. I want to thank you so much for joining this boot camp. We covered a lot of information, and I appreciate your participation. And we're going to be taking a break next week, and we'll resume again after that to continue on our journey toward taking the CDE exam. This is Beverly Tomasi, and I'll be signing off, but I will stay live for other questions. So if I lose audio, just stick with me. Thank you so much.